So this idea of angels, powers, authorities, and so forth being subjected to Christ isn't just an idea from Peter. What I want to do, and I think this will probably take two Lord's days, is if we think about a timeline, you know, progressive revelation, right? God reveals more and more things over time. There are some things, actually, that don't show up at all until you get the New Testament. It's newly revealed, all right? Some things show up in the Old and get clarified as things go on. You know, a few months ago, we've mentioned this before, when you get to the time of the early church, like Athanasius, and so this would be like the 3rd century, 4th century AD, he made an argument, all right? He's like, how do we know Christianity is true? Because less people are coming to your idols, your temples, they're not coming to worship anymore, all right? In other words, my God is beating your demons. That would be the argument he would make. Of course, in the time of the New Testament, we have statements like this from Peter and Paul about Christ putting things into subjection, authorities and powers. What exactly are those things? Are those exactly equivalent to national leaders? All right? Is that exactly equivalent to, you know, Tiberius or Augustus? You know? Or is it something not quite that? And does that idea, all right, come from anywhere before the New Testament? As a matter of fact, it does. I mentioned that you can look in, let's see if we put, you know, David-ish right here. Okay? In the Psalms, we'll see some things that I think will be useful for our discussion. If we go further, if you go back to Moses, all right, and we're going to specifically look at Deuteronomy, as I told you we would, there's something here that is especially useful for us. But we'll still need to keep going back to, let me break the line, because I don't know when this actually happened. Babel is actually relevant for this theological position here in the New Testament, all right? You actually don't know when you read this until you get to here, because this comments on Babel. But we find out that actually the theology that Paul's actually talking about goes back further than that. And really, there's some aspects of it. If you think about, let's say, creation, you know, don't know exactly when that happened. All right. We're going to look at some things. Now, when's Job? Job is probably somewhere around in here. Yeah. Most people tend to think he's pre-Mosaic law. But there's some things in Job that I actually point to right here in Job 36 or 38. I've got it written down. We'll find it. All right? And so we're going to do a lot of scripture reading, and I don't want to go too quickly. And so this will probably take us a couple weeks to trace this. Now, think in your head real quick. What is the difference between doing theology and doing Bible study? Just think in your head. What might that difference be? When I think of the difference between Bible study and theology, theology is taking... it's sort of like you got a board. It's kind of rough. All right? All right, it's not quite smooth, all right? So you take sandpaper, and you kind of rush the sandpaper across it, and it kind of flattens it out. I think that tends to be one of the main functions of theology, all right? Where the Bible says the same thing in a number of different ways, and we say, okay, let's get to the core of the idea, boil it down to a few words, and we will talk about it generally that way. It's necessary for communication for us to do this, all right? Like, I'll just give you an example, and this is one that will be very relevant for us today. How many gods are there? One God, okay? Okay, that's cool. And then someone says, but there's, I mean, the New Testament calls Satan the god of this world. Okay. What are we doing when we say there's one God? Which we do believe. We believe there is one creator God All right, and then he created some spiritual beings that are above us but below him. And sometimes in the scriptures, those spiritual beings are called gods. Like for example, Satan is called God of this world because he is a spiritual being who does, in a sense, have some level of rulership over the world. We don't want to define that all the time, right? And there might be, you know, other creatures, other spiritual beings in the Old Testament that are called gods, but they're not God because they're just, what we would do is we'd just say, well, they're angels, right? They're angelic beings. They're not in the same category with God, all right? Because we, as a faith, we are monotheistic. There's one true God. Everything else is something created and all that. So what theology does there is it takes that language and says we're going to centralize around this notion of monotheism. There is one God. The negative of this is sometimes if you don't ever go back to the scriptures and think about how it actually talks about things, that can get confusing. All right, you can get confused and go, I thought there was only one God, but here in the New Testament it says Satan is the God of this world. Well, you think about it beforehand and you go, okay, let's... You understand how the language works, and that's not a contradiction for us at all, because we know that he's talking about Satan as a ruler, as a spiritual ruler in the context of this world, that he had a great deal of power, but was certainly not equal to God. Make sense? Today is an activity in Bible study, not theology, in that we're going to jump into some language about the divine, all right, that I think helps us a lot by the time we get to the New Testament. Oh, I forgot. There's a really important thing also in Daniel, I think, that'll be very, very helpful. Okay? Let's start with Job, shall we? This is not unlike the discussion we're going to have when we get to it about Gehenna slash Hades slash hell slash paradise. Not unlike that. Let's start in Job 38. We've recently talked about Job chapters 1 and 2. We'll get to that in just a second because it's very relevant for our discussion. Job chapter 38, while you're turning there, remember the scene. This is where Job is essentially questioning God, right? And God is now responding back to Job, all right, and basically putting Job in his place. There's something here that's very useful for our quest. Job 38, verses 4 through 7. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding. Implication, he doesn't really, actually. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Where are we right now in time? That's where we are. All right? Because we're talking about the creation narrative. All right? When the creation starts getting set forth, and maybe this is pointing to right here, but this is really super early. Is God alone? At that point, at this point, the answer is no. He is not alone. See what it says. When all the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Before this was created, God created his angelic host. All right? Then they're not all the same thing. Not all angels are alike. He created a host of spiritual beings. And they were there with him, all right? They weren't like God, because God was greater than them, and God created them. But they were there. So by the time you get to the Garden of Eden, and you've got Adam and Eve, Satan he's already been created by this point. Okay? And so the way he speaks about this is he calls it the sons of God. Now, we discussed last time, you know, what about that notion, that heretical notion, right? That, well, is, you know, could Jesus and Satan perhaps be brothers? And the answer is no. But in terms of what the Bible's doing when he's talking about these spiritual creatures, he's calling them sons of God. Not in the sense of begotten sons of God, not in the sense of in the exact same nature as God, as Christ is, but as a part of what God has created. All right? As a part of the household of God. Some people will call this group the divine council. Or I think the NET Bible calls it the angelic assembly. I think, if I recall correctly. If any of you have a NET Bible, you can check. And there's actually, this is one place where this whole question of how this is discussed is actually very helpful to have multiple translations open, because they will generally treat it different ways. So, you know, in the beginning was just God by himself alone. But the next thing he did is he created a host of spiritual beings. All right? And what we'll find out is that he will delegate to many of those spiritual beings roles upon the earth. All right? The big picture is he created these, he delegated to them roles on the earth, and then they fell and rebelled. All right? And so by the time you get to the New Testament, they must now be put under the feet of Christ, who will be above all powers, authorities, and dominions. That's ultimately theologically where this develops. Okay, but where does it come from? That's what we're talking about right now. And that's this notion. Now turn to Job chapter 1. You know, there's a few main characters in Job. When it comes to spiritual beings, all right, when it comes to spiritual beings, God and the Satan, whatever that is, are not the only spiritual beings in Job. Job chapter 1, verse 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and the Satan also came among them. Okay? Where is the scene? This is not a scene on earth. God is not standing in Jerusalem, or, of course, at this point, Jerusalem would not be the city of God anyway. All right? This is a scene in heaven. All right? Who's there? Well, the sons of God. Who else? The Satan. All right? Or in chapter 2, verse 1, again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. Now, notice the scene, and we will see this consistently throughout here, okay? God has surrounded himself with spiritual beings, all right? But God is always on top. He's always in control, all right? God is not presenting himself to the Satan and this angelic assembly. They are presenting themselves to him, all right? They recognize their lower status here. They're presenting themselves to him. And that's how Job's troubles get started. Because one of those spiritual beings is the Satan. And the Satan wants to test Job, like he wanted to test Peter later on. Okay? So you see in Job, this very early document within Judaism, this notion that God created. And this is, we don't normally talk about it this way. We always say there's God and there's angels, and some angels rebelled, right? It's not the language they're using here. There's God, and there's some sort of angelic assembly. There's some sort of divine council. And they're not all the same. They are different within that group, but they are all lesser, and they are all created. Now, what I want you to do, especially those of you who have a King James or a New American Standard, is when I read something that says sons of God, you will often see something else. It will often be translated something like rulers or mighty rulers. All right? When you see that, raise your hand, let me know, and we'll read it together so they can hear the other translation, okay? Cool. Any questions about this stuff in Job? Yeah.
Job 1, where you were reading.
Mm-hmm.
Now there's a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord and Satan. Mine doesn't have a "the" there. Any significance in that?
Yeah, it's a question whether, and this is a translational choice, depending on your translation. Is this a person or is this a category of divine being? Is this an accuser, a Satan, because that's what it means, or is it Satan, the being that is the chief of the evil beings in the New Testament? People go different ways on how that should be interpreted, and you could take it either way, and it's a legitimate question, and I don't have an answer. But you can go either way. It is either a category of spiritual being, or it is specifically that one, that chief enemy.
Could it be both?
Well, what people will say, if they take it as Satan himself, that, yeah, he is of that category, potentially. And therefore, it would apply in both cases. Yeah. Any other thoughts? I mean, is this strange to talk about stuff this way? I mean, the Old Testament uses different language than the New Testament does. And, you know, we come from, you know, generally the Reformed tradition. We don't use language this way when we talk about Bible usually, right? Usually when we read this, we'll immediately get some explanation. It doesn't mean what it think it means or what it seems to mean, which is not wrong, all right? These are sons of God in the sense of, not in the Jesus sense, all right, but in the sense of they are of God's spiritual household that he has created to govern everything, all right? Speaking of governing, let's turn to let's go to Psalm 82. No, let's not do that. Let's go in time order. Genesis 11. Yeah. We're getting there. Just as a preview, right? We already know, we know from general stuff, there are archangels and there are angels, all right? Seraphim, cherubim. So there's multiple different terms for things. In Daniel, we'll see that some of them are called princes, all right? Rulers, all right? But we'll flesh that out some as we go. Yeah.
What's an archangel?
Archangel would be like chief. Yeah. Arch anything means chief thing. So archbishop, for example, would be the bishop over other bishops. Yeah. Tower of Babel. Genesis 11. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly." And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. And let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the earth." And notice, you know, this is in exact contradiction to what God told them to do. Multiply, subdue the earth. Alright? Not centralized. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower with the children of man had built. And the Lord said, "Behold, they are one people, and they have all one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do, and nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language. Note, let us go down. Let us go down and confuse their language, so that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. Note, it says, let us go and confuse them. And then it says, then the Lord confused them, confused their language. All right? Now, by itself, this doesn't quite help us in our quest. So turn to Deuteronomy 32. Because we get a little commentary on Babel from Moses. Yes, Isaac?
You keep saying quest. What is it a quest for?
Our quest is to figure out, it's a great question, to trace the idea of Paul and Peter on why Christ needed to subjugate the authorities and powers, and to understand who they are. Right? That's what we want to know. And this this is a question that Frank asked me a few weeks ago. He's like, when we were talking about Satan, how does Satan relate to the authorities and the powers? And so it was a really good question. So I thought we'll stop and we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
Subjugate. Subjugate would be to make someone a subject. Defeat them, put them under your heel. Or, in the new words of the New Testament, make them your footstool. Yeah. Deuteronomy 32. Now, this is a point where, and I'll call these things out, I will want one of you to read from the KJV. So, this is the Song of Moses. Deuteronomy 32. We won't read the whole thing, but let's start at the beginning. Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. May my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, like gentle rain upon the tender grass, and like showers upon the herb. For I will proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God, the rock. His work is perfect, and all his ways are justice. A God of faithfulness and without iniquity, just and upright is he. They have dealt corruptly with him. They are no longer his children, because they are blemished, and they are a crooked and twisted generation. Do you thus repay the Lord, you foolish and senseless people? Is not he your father who created you, who made you and established you? Remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask your father, and he will show you, your elders, and they will tell you. When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the people according to the number of the sons of God. But the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob, his allotted heritage. Somebody with KJV, read verses 8 and 9 for me. Thank you. Okay. When did God separate the sons of Adam?
Babel.
Okay. That's when God had to force the separation of the sons of Adam. One thing he did to do that, which you get explicit commentary on Babel, in the Babel passage itself, was to change their language. All right. There's an additional thing here. All right. Now, the reason why I wanted somebody to read the King James is that last phrase in verse 8. The King James, all right, would say according to the number of the sons of Israel. Does anybody have a New American Standard Bible with them? New American Standard is the only modern translation I know of that translates this as, what you got?
I have a New American Standard.
Okay, so it translates it also as the sons of Israel, right?
Yes.
Okay. All the other modern translations that I looked at translate it as I said, according to the number of the sons of God. So what's going on there ultimately, it is a textual variant. Most modern scholars, for good reason, go, this old reading is not what we want to keep in terms of the sons of Israel. If you think about the logic of it, all right, what would it mean? That God broke the people of the world into as many nations as there were Israelites. Well, there wasn't even an Israel at the time, so I'm not sure that makes much sense. He broke them into as many nations as there were going to be Israelites later. Well, at which time? At this time? Does he mean 12 tribes? Well, there's a lot more than 12 tribes, or 12, you know, different nations at the time. What does that mean? I'm not sure it makes, I don't know what sense it would make. What does make a lot of sense, though, all right, is this basic notion, because we will see this in several places, that when God split them into their languages, all right, and that's, I think, what this means if you go with what most modern translations go with. When God split them into their languages, he also gave them, the different groups, all right, essentially to one of his council to rule, okay? Now, if you think about a lot of the Old Testament, and even this passage where he talks about his God and the greatness of his God, you will also see all over the Old Testament, and even into the New, because they were a polytheistic society, there's the God of this nation, and there's the God of this nation, and there's the God of this other nation, all right? Now, the Israelites know, all right, that those gods aren't like Yahweh. They're demons. What we would call in our parlance, they're demons. They are generally fallen angelic creatures. We would actually not argue that they don't exist. We would argue they're not gods. But we would not argue that it's all fiction. All right? There's way too much in the New Testament and the Old Testament about these spiritual beings. All right? The problem is not that they... The theological error is to say that they're the same as God. They're not. They're created beings. It's not a theological error to say they exist. Because demons most certainly do. Yeah.
I just have a question about, so the assembly seemed to be made up in Job of like good angelic beings, mm-hmm. and also bad ones. But then whenever we talk about the nations being given to the sons of God, it seems to be, like you just call them all demons. So mm-hmm. you don't think that any of the nations could have had like a good angelic power that was kind of good?
That's a great question. And so here's the thing, right? How many falls were there? All right, when we think of the fall, right, how many falls were there? We always default to two, right? Fall of Satan and the fall of man, right? Where do we get that idea? Obviously, fall of man is clear, right? One of those. That's really clear. Where do we get the idea that there was one and only one ever fall of angelic beings? I'm guessing it comes from Revelation, right? When you have the rebellion there. But that's A, later. And B, that doesn't necessarily mean there wasn't a time period over which various angelic beings rebelled. All right, I'm not saying there was. All I'm saying is, actually, this is just one of the things the Scripture doesn't actually talk about. When we get to Psalm 82, we will know by then that they have rebelled, because God will rebuke the sons of God who are over the nations, right? In a few hundred years from where we're at here in Deuteronomy. So we know at that point. Like in Babel, there's no clue, there's no hint that whenever this happens that those are actually evil. But by the time of Moses, do we believe that there are evil agencies out there behind the nations by this point? The answer is very strong yes, right? Pharaoh, right? Behind Pharaoh was power, right? Moses did miracles, but so did the others. All right? How did they do that? They had supernatural backing. Not God's supernatural backing, but those pharaohic magicians. There's actually nothing unbiblical about saying they actually had spiritual backing and powerful backing behind them. Yeah.
Sure. Did God give humans their original language and they just knew how to speak and read and write? And then when they're confused, did he give them both languages and then they knew how to read and write? Or?
Good question. No idea. No idea. Yeah. Walter Benjamin. All right, cool.
Something that I've always found confusing is you've got the Babel where they all split up into different languages. But Babel's probably in the Middle East.
Babylon, specifically, yeah.
Okay, so that's what Babel is?
Mm-hmm.
How did they get to China? How did they get to North America?
They walked.
Did God teleport all of them?
They walked.
I mean, how did they get across the seas?
Well, China, you don't have to go over any water. And there was a point at which the Bering Strait was above water, and people could actually walk over there. That is the one between Russia and, Alaska. Yeah, you could actually walk over there at one point. Yeah, it would take a while. Yeah, for sure. But people got there, yeah. Yeah, all that is can be explained, yeah. They got way more steps than Grady gets, you know, when he's walking. And so the notion here, I really do believe, when you're looking at Deuteronomy and he's pointing back to Babel, all right, and think about how this would functionally work, all right, God delegates responsibility, which is, it's maybe unusual for us, but there's nothing theologically that makes that problematic. He has angels do stuff all the time. He's delegated to you to do things, right? He doesn't need you, and he doesn't need angels. He has chosen to use angels, and he's chosen to use you, and he's chosen to use me. And so God is always delegating all sorts of things. And from this perspective of Deuteronomy, is God delegated control over the nations. But verse 9, but the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob, his allotted heritage. And so the notion here is God divided the world up and said, you, angelic being, you go take that group of people. You, spiritual being, you take that group of people. All right? What's my portion? My portion is Jacob. All right? And what we find out as the story goes on, that God is going to use that portion and conquer the world back. That's ultimately the story. Yeah.
So if different countries with supernatural power climate, as in Egypt and magicians, does that mean some of the angels God sent, or spiritual beings, he said were fallen or were already fallen?
It doesn't say when, right? But by the time you get to Moses, there's lots of fallen ones. And when we get to Psalm 82, I'm tired of talking about it. Let's go to Psalm 82. When you get to Psalm 82, you will find that God will now rebuke his counsel. Okay? Psalm 82. This will be another good place for the KJV to come in handy. All right? God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. All right, before we go on, right? It's really clear at this point who's in charge. All right? There's not a question here. And he's going to ask among the divine council, all right? In the midst of the gods, the ESV has, I think KJV has rulers, mighty ones. Mighty ones, yeah. Mm-hmm. In the midst of the gods he holds judgment, how long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Give justice to the weak and fatherless. Maintain the right of the afflicted and the destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. They have neither knowledge nor understanding. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. I said, you are gods, sons of the Most High, all of you. Nevertheless, like men you shall die and fall like any prince. Arise, O God, end of quote, judge the earth, for you shall inherit all the nations. There's that language again about portion. All right. So by the time we get to this point, God is in his assembly looking around and going, you are corrupting, essentially, you are corrupting the nations. That same kind of sin that you saw in Israel all the time that God has to rebuke them for, of taking advantage of the poor and the needy and not caring. This is not an Israelite thing. This is a normal thing, all right? And this is something that these fallen, clearly at this point, fallen beings are doing, all right? And what's the psalmist's hope? It's right there at the end. Arise, O God, judge the earth, for you shall inherit all the nations. That's the goal, all right? That's ultimately the goal. All right, Jacob is the Lord's portion. All right, and when you get to David, he will make a promise to David, and you and your one of your descendants will always reign on the throne. And then through that descendant in the New Testament, God actually does this and starts that process off. Boom, kingdom of God. Jesus Christ making rulers and principalities and powers subject to him and putting them under his footstool. Psalm 89. First few verses. I will sing of the steadfast love of the Lord forever. In my mouth I will make known your faithfulness to all generations. For I said, steadfast love will be built up forever. In the heavens you will establish your faithfulness. You have said, I have made a covenant with my chosen one. I have sworn to David, my servant. I will establish your offspring forever and build your throne for all generations. Let the heavens praise your wonders, O Lord, your faithfulness and the assembly of the holy ones. For who in the skies can be compared to the Lord? Who among the heavenly beings is like the Lord, a God greatly to be feared in the council of the holy ones, and above, awesome above all who are around him. And so I think the KJV will do something like rulers there often as well, in the council of the rulers. The problem is, if you translate, I mean, the rulers are not in the sky. All right? And that's where this is taking place. Who among you in the heavens is greater than you? Well, rulers aren't there. It's not talking about physical rulers. It's talking about powers, authorities, and whatnot. Okay? Not quite the same language, but that is ultimately the theme. Turn to 1 Kings 22. The scene here is you've got the king of Israel and the king of Judah. They're collaborating. And they want to go to war. And they talk to their false prophets. And the false prophets say, yeah, go to war. You're going to do great. All right? You're going to win. They're like, let's call this other guy. He's a prophet of the God of Israel. See what he has to say. Verse 13, So this is 1 Kings 22:13. And the messenger who went to summon Micaiah said to him, "Behold, the words of the prophets with one accord are favorable to the king. Let your word be like the word of one of them and speak favorably." But Micaiah said, "As the Lord lives, what the Lord says to me, that I will speak." And when he had come to the king said to him, "Micaiah, shall we go to Ramoth Gilead to battle, or shall we refrain?" And he answered him, "Go up and triumph. The Lord will give it into the hand of the king." But the king said to him, "How many times shall I make you swear that you speak to me nothing but truth in the name of the Lord?" And he said, "I saw all Israel scattered on the mountains, as sheep that have no shepherd. And the Lord said, 'They have no master. Let each return to his home in peace.' And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, 'Did I not tell you that he would not prophesy good concerning me, but evil?' And Micaiah said, 'Therefore hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, and all the host of heaven standing beside him on his right hand and on his left. And the Lord said, Who will entice Ahab that he may go up and fall at Ramoth Gilead?' And one said one thing, and another said another. Then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord, saying, 'I will entice him.' And the Lord said to him, 'By what means?' And he said, 'I will go out and will be a lying spirit in the mouth of his prophets.' And he said, 'You are to entice him, and you shall succeed. Go out and do so. Now therefore, behold, the Lord has put a lying spirit in the mouth of all these your prophets. The Lord has declared disaster for you.' God had decided he would kill Ahab, and this is how he would do it. But notice the scene, which is why we read it. God is amongst the hosts. Who are the hosts? It's the council. All right? God decided to kill Ahab. How are we going to do it? And one spirit walks forward and says, walks, right? "I will do it. I will entice the false prophets to essentially get him to a battle he can't win, and so he will die." And God says, "Okay, do it." And that is how it happened. Okay? So here we are in Kings, and so this is after David, right? This is in the divided monarchy. You still have God talking to his council. Now, it doesn't say how many of these are fallen. Are all of them fallen, or some of them fallen, and they have not yet been removed from the presence of God? It doesn't actually say. But you do have a spirit here that wants to deceive. So, you know, maybe he's not one of the good ones. But it doesn't really, that's not the purpose of this passage. The purpose is not to talk about the divine counsel. But it does talk about it as a part of its goings on. Last thing, let's look at Daniel. Daniel is going to be one of the last things written in the Old Testament. Not the last, but one of the last. Certainly towards the end, right? Because Daniel is in Babylon and in Persia, right? We are getting into the intertestamental period when we get to Daniel. And this will be Daniel chapter 10. So Daniel is having a vision. All right. Let's start reading in Daniel 10, verse 10. All right. He's in the middle of a terrifying vision of a man. And behold, an angelic being. And behold, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. And he said to me, "O Daniel, man greatly loved, understand the words that I speak to you. And stand upright, for now I have been sent to you." And when he had spoken this word to me, I stood up trembling. Then he said to me, "Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your heart to understand and humbled before your God, your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words. The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days, but Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. For I was left there with the kings of Persia, and came to make you understand what is to happen for your people in the latter days, for the vision is for days yet to come." So you've got an angelic being, all right, that is before Daniel. He's been fighting, All right, he's been fighting the prince of Persia. All right, now we know about angelic beings. Angelic beings are a great deal more powerful than humans. Okay, if an angelic being wanted to fight against a human prince of Persia, human prince of Persia would in fact be dead. All right, that's not what's going on here. This is the same idea. All right. Because we don't talk this way and we don't think about gods of nations fighting gods of other nations, that's not the world we grow up in, and that's the world they live in. We don't talk this way, but the notion is, in charge of Persia, all right, is not just a king of Persia. There is a spiritual being, a spiritual entity that is there controlling Persia. And so he was fighting it. He couldn't quite defeat it yet, though. But who came to help him? Another angelic being, Michael. If you look down a few verses, let's go to verse 18. Again, when having the appearance of a man, touched me and strengthened me, and he said, O man greatly loved, fear not. Peace be with you, be strong, and of good courage. And he spoke to me. I was strengthened and said, Let my Lord speak, for you have strengthened me. Then he said, Do you know why I have come to you? But now I will return to fight against the prince of Persia. And when I go out, behold, the prince of Greece will come. But I will tell you what is inscribed in the book of the truth. There is none who contends by my side except Michael, your prince. Okay? Yeah.
The C.S. Lewis books, mm-hmm. instead of angels being assigned or even to people, they're assigned to nations.
Yeah. And when we think about, you see this in the New Testament, not quite as much, but you do see it, all right? You take Revelation, for example. Who's the beast? Nero's the beast, all right? But Nero is not a multi-headed dragon. All right, it's an image, all right? But it's a fitting image because Satan, all right? Satan is in control of that beast. All right? He brought that beast up so that he could wage war against the saints. Oh, what about the land beast? Satan, yeah, he sent him too, right? Cuz he was also going to make war against them as well. And so these images for us are weird because we don't think, well, right now we're doing war against the angel of Afghanistan, right? We don't think that way. But what is, from a biblical standpoint, all right, when you see a country do something evil, all right, from a biblical standpoint, there is nothing strange about saying, that's not just man evil. That's demonic evil, all right? Because from a biblical worldview, it's not just humans doing bad things in all of these nations. There are beings that must be defeated. And if Israel would have been obedient, like David, he would have subjected them. But they can't, and we know that story. And so ultimately, the subjection of the nations doesn't begin here. Right? The subjection of the nations, of the rulers and the powers and the authority, and then therefore the people in them, starts here. All right? So next week we'll plan on hitting some things in the New Testament and discussing those. All right? Because, I mean, a lot of this is just Old Testament background that ultimately doesn't need to get repeated in the New Testament. And so I think it's background theology. There are demons. We call them demons, all right? That's our word for it. We call them demons, but they exist. They were there in the Old Testament, influencing things the whole time. Lesser than God, created by God, but put in place by God, according to Moses and Deuteronomy. But then fallen, corrupting the nations, and now must be defeated. Any questions, thoughts about that? Yeah.
Because there was angelic beings behind the old nations,
I see no reason why they couldn't be. Yeah. So I'm saying it's if Satan is around in any sense, then the demons are also going to be around. And if you think about Athanasius, all right, in the third century, Athanasius didn't deny that demons exist. What he said was, "We're winning. God said He would put everything under the feet of Jesus, and it's happening." He'll write that in a book and send that to people, right? He's confident enough. Are we confident enough for that? He's confident enough to write in a book and said, "You're losing right now, right? You're losing. My God's beating you right now. Repent." That's a bold attitude, and it's a, theologically speaking, it's very consistent with what Paul was, or Peter was saying, in terms of Christ's position and what he was doing.
I mean, at least in a smaller sense, they have to have been decreased in power.
Mm-hmm.
Like when Jesus said, "How can I take what's in the strong man's house unless I tie him up?"
Yeah.
Okay, you can be here, but I take what I want. We got an understanding here, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. All over. I mean, Britain, which we have a lot of background from Christianity, they were not Christians until converted.
Until the Christians showed up, yeah. Yeah.
I think we have to be careful, but especially if you read some history, There's like tangible evil. We know that Satan, one of the things that Satan wants to do is to kill people.
Hmm.
Because if he kills them and they're not converted, they're lost forever. And he comes to kill and to destroy. And when you have things like Berlin in the 1940s, is there a spiritual element to that? I certainly believe that. Pol Pot, the United States Supreme Court in 1973, was Satan himself there? Maybe. Yeah. I mean, these are huge things that result in massive death,
mm-hmm.
humanity.
The Bible is a very supernatural book, right? You recognize that, right? Our tradition, the Reformed tradition, right, comes out of the Reformation, comes out of the world of the post-Enlightenment, right? It is very easy for us to tone down the demonic aspect of things. And I think it is certainly worth asking ourselves the question, should we? And to what degree should we tone down that language? Because it is abnormal for those, you know, who read a lot, you know, in the Reformed tradition. To me, it would seem abnormal to focus on that in that theological tradition. But it's all over the Old Testament, and in the New Testament, as we will see, there's a lot of stuff in there too. So theology, right? It smooths down rough edges and generalizes and gets you to an average, all right? But you lose data, all right? You take a bunch of numbers, you average them together, get an average. If you don't keep those numbers, you lose data. Okay? Maybe that's not a good analogy. Michael, get it. Yeah, right? You will lose data if you throw away the original and just stick with the average. That's what theology does. It is an averaging function. It takes disparate things and gets us something easier to deal with. Okay, so next time, if you want to look, read Ephesians, Colossians, 1 Peter, and Jude. Those would be good things to read. All right? Ephesians, Colossians, 1 Peter, and Jude. We'll hit some other things too.